I want to give a very special thank you to the sponsor of this episode. My conversation with Dr. A.J. Levine today is sponsored by Graz College. Graz College offers advanced degrees and certificates for professionals. You can expand your knowledge and leadership skills with an online graduate degree in education or earn your doctorate in education leadership. Graz College is fully accredited and designed for busy professionals. Some of the courses are offered as accelerated 8-week courses. Visit graz.edu to learn more. Graz is spelled G-R-A-T-Z. Starting in October 2017, I'm teaching at Graz. The course is entitled Understanding and Integrating the Interior Lives of Children. It's for the Master's of Education degree program. This is an accelerated course lasting 8 weeks and is listed as EDU 527. Graz also offers courses in Jewish Christian studies that will benefit any Christian leader, Bible teacher, pastor, or chaplain. And as the oldest independent college of Jewish studies in North America, you might guess that their specialty is Jewish studies. That's right. Be sure to see what might interest you from a wide array of fascinating course choices. You can register at graz.edu for an online info session, and you can find Graz on Twitter and Facebook too. Thank you, Graz College, for sponsoring this episode. Let's get started. Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. I'm really delighted to have A.J. Levine on my program today. She is the University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies, the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Professor of New Testament Studies, and Professor of Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt Divinity School and College of Arts and Science in Nashville, Tennessee. She describes herself as a Yankee Jewish feminist who teaches at a predominantly Christian divinity school in the buckle of the Bible Belt. And she is the author of The Misunderstood Jew, The Church and the Scandal of the Jewish Jesus, The Meaning of the Bible, co-written with Douglas Knight, Short Stories by Jesus, talking about the parables of Jesus, and she is the editor of the Jewish Annotated New Testament, which came out in a new edition this year. I'm really excited to speak with you, AJ. Thank you so much for being a guest on my show.
Oh, happy to join you. I have to put in one minor correction. Back in this past May, I shifted endowed chairs, so the Carpenter chair is now sitting under someone else, and I am officially the Mary Jane Worthen Chair in Jewish Studies.
And so I'm in the position of being a non-Jew working at a Jewish college, Graz College near Philadelphia. And Graz College is also sponsoring this show. I'm really excited that Graz is opening up soon a master's program in Jewish Christian Studies and promoting interfaith dialogue and really opening the doors to a lot more studying of comparative theology. And I had already wanted you on the show, and then this came up, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is so perfect to be able to talk to you about these things as well as your books and specifics about parables and things like that. And I guess one of the things that I have a mostly Christian audience, but there's a lot of people who don't even think, they will say things like, now, if Jesus were back, would he come to your church? And it's like, no, he'd go to a synagogue. You realize he's Jewish, right? Like, all his apostles were Jewish. They were going to synagogues. And I think this fact escapes people, and we don't often, or without actual awareness as Christians, sometimes really understand how Jewish Jesus was. So I was hoping you could also paint a picture a little bit of what we mean when we say a first century Jewish Jesus. What are we talking about when that's presented in the Bible? It's a really far-flung idea for a lot of modern Christians today, and maybe you could get into that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it seems a little weird to me that if Christians who actually read the Gospels, which not all do, come out with the idea that somehow Jesus isn't Jewish. So what do we know about him? I mean, he goes to synagogues where he argues with other Jews. I mean, nothing new there. He keeps the dietary laws. We never see him, chowing down on a ham sandwich. He wears fringes when he complains about Pharisees making their fringes broad and long. The suspicion is that his are sort of short and stubby. And it's those fringes that the hemorrhaging lady seeks to grab hold of so that she can obtain a healing. He's concerned about the temple in Jerusalem, as many Jews were. He was probably not filled with leadership, as many Jews weren't. If he thought the temple was just so incredibly awful, then it makes no sense that his followers continued to worship there. He is highly invested in Torah, and he does what other Jews do, which the rabbis would call building a fence about the law. So what do? We have a law. We make another law to make sure you don't violate the first one. So we have a law that says don't murder. Jesus says don't be angry. We have a law that says don't commit adultery. Jesus says don't think about it. That's a very Jewish way of functioning. His entire ministry is targeted toward Jews. In fact, in the Gospel of Matthew, he says, don't go to the Gentiles and don't go to the Samaritans, but just go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So he's a Jew who follows Torah, whose path is set out by what Christians would call the Old Testament and Jews would call the Tanakh, describes in terms of what God would want. His followers are fully engaged in not only Jewish beliefs, but Jewish practices. And his entire messianic identity only takes shape because of what Jews were thinking in various ways at the time of what a Messiah is and what a Messiah does.
Maybe you could shed a little bit of light on the interaction that happens in one of the Gospels that I've never been able to understand in the interpretations that I've heard, maybe you could shed a little bit of light on it, where the woman who wants her daughter healed says to her, I can't take food from the children and throw it to the dogs. And she talks about even the dogs can get crumbs from the table.
Yep. It's told in two different ways. It's told in Mark chapter 7, where the woman is identified as a Greek Syrophoenician, which is a fairly hoity-toity identification, like, a Biddle who came over on the Mayflower. And it also shows up in Matthew 15, where the woman is called a Canaanite, which is not a hoity-toity identification, but does evoke the ancient Canaanites whom Joshua was called to wipe out. The story has different functions in each of these two texts. So if we take the Matthew version, which is actually longer, weirdly, because Matthew usually shortens Mark's stories, what's happening here that we miss because we're not first century readers is that the texts are playing on a literary convention, which is sometimes known as the meek king. And in these stories, somebody in a position of enormous authority, in this case Jesus, is approached by somebody who lacks authority, in this case the Canaanite woman. And the person in authority basically says, I'm too busy, I'm too important, you're not part of my job description, or you're not at my table. And the person who lacks social capital, through a word of cleverness, manages to keep the conversation going and thus obtains what he or she wants. We already know from the Gospel of Matthew that the woman is going to get what she wants, because back in Matthew's genealogy in chapter 1, which is how the New Testament begins, we have a Canaanite woman named Rahab, and we know from the stories of Rahab back in the book of Joshua that she's going to be the faithful one when the men with whom she is paired are not faithful. Mm-hmm. We have Tamar, first woman mentioned in the New Testament, who's probably a Canaanite. And she, in the book of Genesis, chapter 38, displays enormous fidelity when the man with whom she is paired, Judah, the son of Jacob, shows a little bit less fidelity. So we already know that Matthew has set us up. The woman is going to succeed. She's going to meet a man who's initially going to show resistance. And she, through an enormously clever word, is going to get what she wants. Another thing that the story teaches us, which is consistent with the Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew chapters 5 through 7, is she's showing the Jewish way of how do you respond to a violent comment? Like, I'm not going to heal your daughter and you're a dog. and I don't think he said that with a smile on his lips and a twinkle in his eye. I mean, to call a woman a bitch is not helpful. And even though Matthew says puppies, to call a woman a little bitch is not much better than to call her a bitch. So it really is an insult. It's a cross-cultural insult. She could have said, you want to call me a bitch? Well, screw you. Which just heightens the violence and doesn't get accomplished what needs to be accomplished. Or she could have said, okay, I'm a dog, and then slunk away. But what she does is she said, you're going to call me a bitch, fine. I'm going to absorb the insult, And I'm going to say, fine, you want to call me a bitch? Sure. But even dogs are entitled. There is enough bread to go around. Mm-hmm. And that's why in Mark's gospel, Jesus says, because of your word, let it be to you as you wish. Matthew says because of your faith, but that's a nice Matthean code word, because Matthew typically says because of your faith, anything can happen. Mm-hmm. So what we learn here is, if you're an apostle or you're a church leader or you're somebody in authority, and the apostles are there in Matthew while this dialogue is happening, you pay attention to the people who you think are not important who you think are not part of your community. They are deserving too, because they are also God's people. And to people who lack social capital, don't insult, don't slink away, keep the conversation going, absorb the violence, but hold firm to your dignity and to your rights.
And so every gospel has sort of a different intent. What do you think the differences are between the two stories in that case?
Mark is explaining in part how non-Jews come into the system. Mm-hmm. He may also be interested in the relationship between Northern Galilee and Tyre and Sidon, since this woman is identified as a Syrophoenician by birth. And since the scene is set in the area of Tyre and Sidon were at the time taking resources from Northern Galilee and using them. Mm. So this might be a case of Jesus speaking up on behalf of the people whose resources are being siphoned off. Excuse me, lady, you've taken enough from me and you've taken enough from us. In the Gospel of, but she also says, yes, but I need something too. So I may have all the wealth in the world, but I don't have a healing, and that's something you can provide me. In the Gospel of Mark also, Jesus is looking for some downtime. Jesus typically in Mark withdraws for solitude, his own personal revitalization. And she's interrupting him, and he has to give her something that he might not be inclined to do at the time. He's very, very human in Mark. For Matthew, the concern is, what do we do with the Canaanites, these people who were supposed to have been wiped out by Joshua? But the book of Joshua itself tells us that Rahab and her followers, her community, are still with the people to this day. So there's a concern here about, how do we read the Bible? Do we celebrate slaughter, or do we recognize survivors? Do we look at the Jewish tradition as something that's interested in wiping out Canaanites? Or do we recognize that Jews limit this question of genocide to the so-called 12 nations of Canaan, and realize that when we look at the Talmud, the whole issue of holy war only occupies one paragraph out of a multi-volume text, and that Jews are not interested in that type of genocide from the ancient text on. Mm. So what we do with these texts is not even say, here's what they teach, but here's what they continue to teach, and here are some of the messages we continue to take from them. Another place we can go is the Jewish tradition of the righteous Gentile, which we already have in the scriptures of Israel, righteous Gentiles like Rahab, like Pharaoh's daughter, like Ruth, the Moabite, and say, look, part of the Jewish tradition says that fidelity, good deeds, honorable behavior, that's not only what Jews do, that's what we're all supposed to do, and we Jews can learn something from people on the outside.
I wanted to talk a little bit about short stories by Jesus, the enigmatic parables of a controversial rabbi. Just really digging in and loving this book so much. And I think one of the things you stress in here is that there's a big disconnect with the Jewish understanding of parables. And a lot of things in the Bible are tainted for Christians by an anti-Jewish sentiment, and that Christians might not be aware, or often are not even aware of that anti-Jewish sentiment and interpretation, and what parables are all about. So what is this about parables that most people don't quite understand, that deals with the problem or the paradox of them?
Yeah, parables are not sweet little children stories, although they're frequently told in churches to children. So the adult Christian thinks, oh, Good Samaritan, Prodigal Son. Those are kids' stories because I heard those in, you know, vacation Bible school or in Sunday school, and they're not really important for adults. Parables are told to adults. You can see that in the New Testament itself. And they're designed to challenge, to shake up the status quo, to indict, and to provide us better ethical models than we might actually be practicing. generally they don't tell us something new. They tell us something that we've already known deep down, but we've more or less managed to repress them. What often happens in parables, too, is that contemporary Christian readers, or Christian readers through the centuries, have been importing anti-Jewish stereotypes. And it's a failure here, I think, of Christology. It's a failure here of even recognizing how good Jesus is, because you don't need to make Judaism look awful in order to make Jesus look splendid. But what these various stereotypes do is invent an awful Jesus over against which an awful Judaism over against which Jesus looks terrific. And that's just unhelpful. So, for example, Christians may often read the parable of the prodigal son to say, oh, well, the father in the parable is God, and the Jewish God was angry and wrathful and nasty, and this parable tells us that God is actually really nice. Well, the Jewish God has a strong sense of justice, but the Jewish God also has an enormous sense of compassion. So we don't need a parable to tell us that God is compassionate. We already knew that. We don't need parables to tell us that God is there to forgive the repentant sinner. That's all the way through the Jewish tradition. So clearly, then, the parable has to be saying something other than these obvious points. And when we look at the parable in its Jewish context, and we look at the father in the parable just as a father, we realize our concerns for, have we made everybody feel counted? Here's a man with two sons, and he forgets to invite his older son to the party? Wow. And then what do we do with a disaffected child who has felt overlooked because baby brother has sucked out all the oxygen in the room? How do we be better parents? How do we be better individuals who have to make everybody in our purview feel wanted, feel counted, and feel invited?
And one of the parables that I was really deeply enjoying was the one, the kingdom of heaven is like yeast. I definitely had never thought about it in some of the ways that you flesh out. And would you mind describing that one a little bit?
Yeah. You find frequently in Christian sources that yeast is some sort of impurity or contaminant. And by comparing the kingdom of God to yeast, that Jesus has somehow done away with the purity laws. Well, that's total nonsense, as any Jew who has ever eaten a hot dog, you know, on a roll with, you know, mustard and sauerkraut knows, or any who has ever had challah on Friday evening at the beginning of the Shabbos, beginning of Shabbos knows. But we also know that just as today we can say one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. It doesn't mean that apples are awful, but we can see how apple can be used with a negative valence. The New Testament gives us a number of images of yeast with a negative valence. Like Jesus says, beware of the leaven, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees and the Herodians. You know, and the disciples, who were clearly not the brightest students in the seminar, say things like, oh, he's worried that we didn't bring bread, because they wouldn't recognize a metaphor if it hit him over the head. So when Jesus starts comparing the kingdom of heaven to yeast within this context, that might have gotten a rise out of the audience, as one might be inclined to say. It's also saying, you know, you don't need to compare the kingdom of heaven to pearly gates or golden slippers. That the kingdom of heaven can be found, oh, at the communal oven of a Galilean village where everybody has enough food. Or maybe it sends us back to where three measures of flour shows up elsewhere in the scriptures of Israel. Because just as a parable about a father and two sons sends us immediately back to Cain and Abel, or Isaac and Ishmael, or Jacob and Esau, so three measures of flour sends us back to Genesis 18, where Abraham welcomes three strangers to lunch, and he gets the good news that his wife Sarah, who's way menopausal, is about to have a baby. So maybe this talks about the kingdom of heaven is there when you invite people to lunch who might be strangers, because those people who might need some sustenance may be representatives of God. Or maybe because the woman is not simply kneading yeast and dough or mixing yeast, she's actually hiding it, that we find sometimes the kingdom of heaven comes in unexpected ways, or sometimes even through subterfuge, or sometimes through looking at what we've already always done, but we use a different verb, and that sheds completely new light on what we're doing. So the parable opens up to multiple messages, like this overflowing dough, because three measures of flour is about 60 pounds. There's more to this parable than we can possibly get in one mouthful.
You put a few good puns in there. I hope people re-listen to this and pick them all up.
I tried to do that through the entire book, and people have told me that they sit there and say, could she possibly have just said this? And the answer is yes.
It's juicy. I'm telling you, it's juicy. And on page 301, I hope everybody gets this short stories by Jesus as well as your other work, but the short stories by Jesus is particularly good for the ADD Twitter addicted reader, because it's little, you know, little nuggets in here. And this one in particular, this is a really good thing for people to realize. On page 301, it says, if the interpretation of the story told by a Jew to other Jews is based on or yields a negative stereotype of Judaism, then the interpretation has got more lost than the sheep, coin, or sons, and cannot and should not be recovered. Maybe you can say something to that.
Figure out at the end of interpreting a parable, whether you hear it in a sermon or encounter it in a Bible study, or you're just doing personal devotion, and you ask, what does this parable mean to me? Or better, what does this parable do? How does it make me feel? What does it remind me of? And you come up with a, gosh, those Jews were really awful, weren't they? That's not a terribly helpful message. It's certainly not good news for anyone. And again, it's that model of making Jesus look good by making Judaism look bad. So it's taking away from Jesus himself and the good teachings that he offers.
Now, you talk a little bit about resisting taming parables, and that you also mentioned that Luke does a bit of taming of the parables. And maybe I would love to know a little bit, have you talk about why does Luke do this and you know, our temptation to go along and tame them as well?
Yeah, I think it might be part of just the human way of existing, that we want to bring meaning and we want to bring closure. So when we have a story that's open to multiple interpretations, or better, a story that challenges us or asks us to be better than we already are, resistance comes in. You know, we're just fine as we are, and we don't want to be challenged, and we want closure. So what happens is we provide singular interpretations. What Luke is doing is, in effect, what people generally do in a church sermon, where, you know, depending upon your denomination, you've got between 8 minutes and an hour and a half, to say, here's what I want to do with this parable. And we want to tie it up in a neat little bow, because the congregation often does not want to go out wondering or speculating or pondering. They just want it all tied up so we can get to the last hymn and then get to lunch. So Luke is an interpreter of parables, as any reader is an interpreter of parables, and Luke is doing what any interpreter does. Luke is saying, here's what the parable means, or at least here's what the parable means to me. So Luke takes a parable about a sheep owner. The text never says shepherd, it just says sheep owner, who loses the sheep. It doesn't say the sheep went astray. The guy lost the sheep. And then Luke turns it into a parable about repenting and forgiving. So after the sheep owner goes on this frantic search for the sheep and finds it and throws a party, Luke then says, there's more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 who are righteous. So what Luke does is turn the parable into an allegory about repenting and forgiving. But, you know, any Jew hearing a parable about a sheep owner who lost the sheep and then found it, I don't think is getting repenting and forgiving here. Don't repent. There's no shame. Plus, the guy lost the damn sheep. So maybe we can read it as about repenting and forgiving. And that's a lovely message. And I don't want to take that away. I think that's a splendid message. But I don't think it's what the parable originally meant. So what I'm trying to do in this volume is step back behind 2,000 years of Christian interpretation, including the interpretation that Matthew, Mark, and Luke give us. There aren't any parables in John. And in an act of what might be considered historical imagination, recognizing that parables are stories designed to challenge rather than to comfort, try to figure out what first century Jews might have heard.
Yeah. Well, tell me a little bit about some of the recent things you've been working on, including the annotated New Testament. What, for someone who doesn't know what that is, what that involves, and then some of the other projects you've been working on recently or that are coming up.
The original Jewish Annotated New Testament was published by Oxford University Press in 2011. Mark Brettler, who teaches at Duke, and I are the co-editors. And we have about 50 Jewish authors doing full commentary on the entire New Testament. So introduction, footnotes, annotations to each book of the New Testament. And then in the back, we have a number of essays, very short, user-friendly essays. What was the temple? What was Jewish family life like? How have Jews looked at Jesus over the centuries? How have Jews looked at Paul over the centuries? And Oxford came back to us a couple of years ago and said, we'd like to do a second edition, fully revised and expanded. And that will be published in September. So what we did is we changed out a number of notes. In cases where we put rabbinic literature or Dead Sea Scroll information or Philo and Josephus, stuff contemporaneous or later in Jewish sources that would shed light on some of the text, instead of just giving the verses, we actually said what the verses say, because we know that people aren't going to look this up. We threw in another 30 essays. We contracted with another 30 Jewish annotators to do this material. And we also included introductory matters like what's a gospel and what are the Pauline letters and how was the canon fit together and how do you understand apocalyptic literature? So this becomes not only a study Bible, but a basic introduction to the New Testament that could be used in a classroom. In cases where we as annotators know that certain Christian readings have gotten off track, not because of anti-Judaism and not because of bigotry, but because of ignorance, we pull out little gray boxes that say, you might be inclined to read this text this way. Here's why that's not a good idea, and here's how you can read the text instead. So in that sense, the Bible is, and I'm not sure you can use this term in Bible in the same sentence, but the Bible, the annotated Jewish annotated New Testament, becomes a prophylactic. In other words, it is designed to prevent Christian anti-Jewish views from continuing to be promulgated.
What a fantastic resource. That sounds wonderful. You said it's coming in September.
It's coming out in September.
Oh, great. September 2017, for anybody listening to this in the distant future. But cool. Yeah, that's wonderful. And also, what are some of the other things? You have a children's book. Is it out already?
I wrote a children's book with noted children's book author Sandy Eisenberg Sasse, who is also the first woman ordained by the Reconstructionists. She's a retired rabbi now from India. And she knows how to write children's books. So she and I are good friends, and we were lamenting at one point the dearth of really good children's books about Jesus. They're either somberific or scary or anti-Jewish or all three. So we thought, let's do a book on the parables of the lost in Luke chapter 15. So this would be the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the father with two sons. For children, and the target age is 3 to 7. So the question then was, who's going to publish this thing? And we went to a number of presses, Christian presses, and they turned it down despite initial great enthusiasm. The boards of directors turned it down. So to one agent at a press, I said, gee, should I change my name to Mary Agnes? You know, would that help get this thing published? And he said, probably not. But then Westminster John Knox, which is the publication arm of the Presbyterian Church USA, said, this is fantastic. We want to do this, and we want to do a second volume. So a second volume on the parable of the mustard seed is currently with the illustrator. And we're now talking about two more volumes. We're tracking the readings in short stories by Jesus. And Sandy has an enormous talent of taking very difficult material and presenting it to kids, but not in a dumbed down way. And the illustrator has done just a terrific job in providing visuals that I think help both adults and children. Take from the parables challenges. For each book, we've put it in the back a note to parents and teachers saying, here's how you might use this book. Here are the traditional readings of the parables. Here are some of the questions you can ask children so that they can help enter into the parable and make the story their story.
Can you go into a little more description for that?
Sure. For the parable of the father with two sons, we can ask children, if you identify with the older son, have you ever felt that you've been overlooked, that your parents paid more attention to a sibling than to you, or a teacher has paid more attention to some children in the classroom rather than you? Have you ever wanted to go away from home and explore and engage in adventure, and is that scary or is that interesting? Have you ever lost anything, and then when you found it, did you celebrate? Did you call your friends? Why was this thing that you lost important to you? Have you ever been to a party that was a party for somebody else and felt kind of left out?
Yeah.
There are various ways that you can engage this. Because the parable book here is about counting, have you ever counted? And how do you know you've lost something until you've actually counted up?
So really not for children at all, for everybody, right?
Well, the parables are designed for adults. We simply put it in children's book format, but adults can learn from children's books.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that's amazing. As I think about the end of your book, it's the book, The Misunderstood Jew. You talk about interfaith possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love to engage with this topic right now, in terms of what we can do to make interfaith dialogue more dynamic and more productive for all parties involved. What are some of your ideas, and what are some of the good directions we can go in?
Yeah, well, if we're talking specifically about Jewish-Christian dialogue, and all interfaith or interreligious dialogue takes its specifics from the faiths or the religions being involved.
Mm-hmm.
But in Jewish-Christian dialogue, it sometimes happens that the Jews come in as the victim and the Christians come in as the perpetrator. And any Jew involved has all of 2,000 years worth of Christian anti-Jewish teaching to deal with, and so does the Christian. But we don't come in as representatives of our group, and we should not be expected to know everything about Judaism and or Christianity. We come in as individuals, so we come in as you know, Frimma Sarah and Mary Margaret, you know, rather than the Jew and the Christian.
Mm-hmm.
We come in being willing to ask the hard questions, like, you know, why do you do this? Or how does this belief manifest itself in your life? Or why do you think this is important? Or what does this ritual mean to you? We have to be brave enough to ask the questions we've always wanted to ask. Interfaith or interreligious dialogue is not a place for proselytism. So if the idea is to come in to convince somebody else that you're right and that other person's wrong, then we're not engaging in dialogue. But at the same time, we need to hold fast to what we really do believe and be able to express that. So if the Christian thinks, you know, I really do believe you have to, you the Jewish person, have to accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior and get baptized, then I think the Christian should be able to say that. And the Jew should respond, well, here's why I'm not finding that, you know, on my calendar for next Tuesday. Here's how I understand what you're saying. And at the same time, the Jew should be able to recognize that the Christian is not making that claim because of anti-Jewish thoughts or because of bigotry, but those claims are made out of love and concern. So then we can have an open and honest conversation. Even if we're talking about interfaith dialogue, very often the Jew entering that dialogue is not coming from a faith perspective. The Jew entering that dialogue might come from the perspective of, say, an atheist, because one does not need to have a belief system in terms of theology in order to be Jewish. To be Jewish is to be a member of the Jewish people.
Right.
Mind of, you know, Einstein or, you know, Freud or folks like that. But we come in saying, here's what being a Jew means to me. And the meaning may be very surprising to the Christian who's expecting a creed, and instead we get concerns for ethics or concerns for history or concerns for cultural practices rather than beliefs per se.
That's a really interesting point that I think can make people in Christian circles really want to defend their faith and not wrestle with it and not wrestle with doctrine and different ideas, because there isn't a cultural backdrop or a kinship, literal familial backdrop. So once you give up your belief, there's nothing left. There's nothing else to keep you there. No necessarily a cultural community or something like that. Whereas, at least I remember hearing this on Pete N's show, which I listen to all the time, The Bible for Normal People. He's been talking with a lot of people out of Jewish tradition in various forms of belief, that it's not like you can give, you're Jewish or you're not, you know, and then there's different spectrum of practice or belief. And so everything can be debated from that point on.
But don't even think about it as a debate, because debates have winners and losers. Think about it as a conversation, the desire to know the other person. And when this type of dialogue really works, then you get to know yourself better, because you might then see your own tradition, your own values reflected with different language or used in different forms of imagery, and say, oh, I never thought about it that way. But yeah, that makes sense. That's where dialogue can be really productive. So debate is not the right word coming in.
Yeah, exactly. And also, you know, I've noticed just within my own life is reading a lot of diverse perspectives. It's actually like, oh, actually, I can hold two opposing thoughts in tension in my mind, and the world will not fall apart.
So, yeah, I mean, we're based on paradox anyway.
Yeah. It's actually hard to not find it when you're looking close enough. You'll find, oh, actually, my life does contain all this paradox. I just wasn't looking hard enough.
Mm-hmm. Or we sometimes have what's called a willing suspension of disbelief. So, the Christian might say, yes, I celebrate Christmas, but I'm not sure that everything in the Gospels recorded about Jesus' nativity actually happened exactly the way that the Gospels describe it. And that's fine, too.
And maybe Santa wasn't there.
Oh, no.
Like Santa. He's pretty awesome. I wanted to ask you, too, about, I believe that you have a place in Israel, where you live, and you just returned from there, and maybe you can tell.
I don't live in Israel. No, because each summer I've been going to Australia. That's very different.
Oh, very different. Yeah, and that's like a normal tradition that you have.
I just got back from most of my time was spent in Queensland with a brief stop off in New South Wales. I've been working the past several years with Catholic religious educators throughout the continent of Australia. Primarily with primary and secondary school teachers to help figure out how to reinforce Catholic identity, as well as to talk about how to study the Bible within its Jewish context, because the Catholic Church, particularly in Australia, is very invested in teaching its students about the Jewish roots of Christianity and the 2,000 years worth of history between the Catholic Church and the Jewish people. So it's a splendid program.
Thank you for correcting me on that one. That was a big mistake.
Oh, no, that's okay. My husband is actually allergic to sesame products, which, in his words, it makes him an anti-Sesamite. So the very idea of living in Israel would be just too dangerous with all the hummus and tahina.
Oh, my goodness. That's funny. I was also curious to ask you this, too, because I know from an early age you lived in a predominantly Catholic neighborhood when you were growing up? And because your interest in things religious or belief-based happened from such a formative age, can you imagine what you would be doing if it weren't the profession you are doing now?
Oh, I'd be a lawyer and probably happily retired on a multi-million-dollar payout from the firm.
You already know.
I know. I mean, my mother wanted me to be a lawyer. She put it when I was quite young. She said, you have a brain and you have a mouth. Go be a lawyer. and I like the law. But when I was in high school, I attended a couple of sessions of law school. My stepsister married a fellow who was in law school, and I used to go to class with him, and I could not have been more bored. So I thought, okay, this is probably not happening. I think I was also negatively affected by the movie The Paper Chase. I very much like the law, and I'm interested in what it can do for justice. I'm interested in minority as well as majority opinions, and that's part of what the Talmud is, because the Talmud is very much a legal document. How do you look at how people behave, and then at what point does the community step in, or for law, at what point does the state step in? So what I can do today is look at how the Bible is sometimes used in legal arguments. I find that absolutely fascinating. From the old question about the Defense of Marriage Act to today, the Supreme Court is about to make decisions about whether people can refuse services to gay couples because of the people's own religious beliefs.
Right. And the community is making up meaning within their context and then putting it out into trying to maintain social order or meaning, social meaning within their context, and also trying to connect that to sort of, connect it to God, but also make it work out in practical life as well.
Right. So we as an American society are frequently saying, you know, what does the Bible say, or the Bible says it, and therefore I believe it. But the Bible speaks in multiple voices, in multiple translations, with multiple canons, depending upon whose Bible we're looking at. And I'm very concerned when the Bible gets used to create hurt. There's an old saying, I did not invent it, but I think it's a good saying. The Bible should be a rock on which you stand rather than a rock thrown to do damage. And I've seen the Bible be used to do an enormous amount of damage. And if I have any ability to correct that, then I want to put my abilities in service to that correction.
And in terms of when I was speaking to Pete Enns the last time, he was just recently on my program again, and he was talking about how in the Hebrew Old Testament scriptures, there's about half of the words are only used once, and there's about 9,000 words in the Old Testament. And if they're only used once, it's very difficult to understand what they could be. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, here, then we have English with these, you know, hundreds of thousands of words or whatever, and we can nitpick over what the English says. Oh, it used this word instead of this word, and so it must connote this meaning. And we're really hair splitting over English words.
Right. Or we say that we have to go to the King James version of the Bible because that's the authorized version. That's on the inside cover. And it's, well, yeah, it was authorized by the King of England, and we're Americans, so how does that work?
Yeah. And he wasn't probably very good at Hebrew. So I'm thinking
for the time, you know. Look, all translators are traitors. So we always have to be careful in whatever translation we're using. We don't have any original manuscript of anything. We're working off of copies of copies of copies of copies, with the text put together as best as we can determine what the original was, if there even were an original. Because texts may have been dictated, and as soon as they're dictated, different scribes are going to record different things. Mm-hmm. So we always have to be careful by saying, you know, this is what the Bible says. We can come as close as possible, but we're never fully going to know. Mm-hmm. Anybody can pick up the Bible and read it, and people have been picking up the Bible. Literate people have been picking up the Bible and read it, and others have been hearing stories. Mm-hmm. I would not cede the meaning of the Bible to the so-called experts, because we don't know either. We don't all agree with each other. And if somebody says, gee, I get my Jesus from this particular scholar or that particular scholar, that's giving those of us who are scholars too much authority. You know? You start on your own, and anybody can do that. And instead of asking, what does this text mean, as if there's one singular meaning, if one is reading the text for devotional purposes, one would say the better question would be, what does this text mean to me in my life at this particular time? How does this text engage me? What am I going to do with this text? What does it motivate me to think about or to do? Or does it inspire me, or does it comfort me? And anybody can do that. But I tend to look at the Bible as a lover. You know, and a really good lover with whom you can disagree, but the relationship is still being maintained. And even though you are in love with someone, you don't have to love absolutely everything about what that person does. There will be some things that might prove to be a tad annoying, like my husband's sesame allergy, which keeps me out of Asian restaurants when I'm having dinner with him. So you wrestle with the text, because that's what the name Israel means, to wrestle with God. But then if you really, really love someone, or you really, really love something, you want to know as much about it as possible. And that's when you go to the scholar. You know, tell me more about this. Give me this opinion. But you collect multiple opinions and you read widely. And then you make your own assessments.
This has been amazing, AJ. I deeply appreciate that you would be my guest.
Oh, what fun to talk with you.
I hope you would come on again, because I feel like we only barely scratched the surface and only talked about a few items, and you have all this rich text here that I've been pouring through. But this has been so nice.
I'd be delighted to join you again. Thank you so much.
Welcome. Do you have any place that would be besides just going to Amazon and looking up your books, is there any place people can find you to get in touch with more of your work and what you do?
Amazon is certainly the easiest thing, and then you can just immediately click and buy, which is really helpful. I have a Facebook page, but I don't even know how to access it. My daughter runs it. and she checks it about once a week and then sends me comments and says, you need to respond to this. So that's a little bit helpful because it triages my time. But I'm apparently all over the internet. I've never looked me up. The very idea is just scary. but, you know, so I'm there and I'm certainly easily found. Yeah, there's a homepage on the Vanderbilt Divinity website with a woefully outdated curriculum vitae, which I'll probably fix sometime in July.
What courses are you teaching this fall?
Let's see. In the fall, I'm teaching an upper-level course on the Gospel according to Mark. And then in the spring, I'm teaching two sections of the New Testament intro, which is required for divinity students and cross-lists with the College of Arts and Sciences in Jewish Studies. So if anybody in the Nashville area wants to come audit a New Testament course, you can probably do it at Vanderbilt in the spring.
Yeah, really greatly appreciated. Thank you so much.
Once again, a pleasure.
Thank you again to the sponsor of this episode, Gratz College. With online graduate degrees in education and online courses and degrees in Jewish studies and engaging courses and upcoming programs in Jewish-Christian interfaith studies, it's truly well worth it to check out Gratz at gratz.edu and tell them I sent you. I'd be delighted if you join me in my online course that runs for 8 weeks in October. And for my monthly patrons of Spark My Muse, check out the bonus audio at patreon.com/SparkMyMuse for this episode. You won't be disappointed. And if you're not a patron, don't be left out. Get started for just $1. You can find out more information about this program at sparkmymuse.com. And you can also sign up for my newsletter that I send out about once or twice a month. Thank you so much for listening today, and check out other episodes in the archive or listen for a new one each Wednesday.